case, the one that got away. Every police officer was haunted by an unsolved case. She flicked her ash on the gravel, and there was a meow as a large black cat appeared from under the bench and rubbed itself against her legs. "Hello," she said, leaning down to stroke it. The cat purred and strutted off to a couple of little dishes under one of the bay windows. It lapped at some water and then sniffed the bowl next to it, which was empty. Linda Douglas Brown came to the front of Erica's mind. Linda the cat lady. So much evidence linked back to her. Linda was supposed to meet Andrea that night at the cinema, but didn't. She'd watched the film with David. They knew that much. But what had happened afterwards? Linda and her obsession with cats. What did she know about Linda? Was she a victim in life? She was obviously not a favourite with her family. She was bitter and envious. She could have killed Andrea. But what about the other women? The prostitutes who had been involved with Igor? Linda knew of Igor. She'd met him. What if she also knew that Igor had killed the three prostitutes? She could have seized the opportunity to make Andrea's murder look like a copycat killing. Copycat. Linda the cat lady. It went round in Erica's mind. Yet Linda didn't have a cat. Peterson had asked her in the interview if she had a cat. She had answered him weirdly. Not right now. And a look had passed across her face. A strange look. Erica hadn't picked up on it at the time, but now it blared out at her. Erica went back up to her room, where she dressed quickly, and after passing the disinterested lad on reception for the second time, she drove over to Lewisham Row Station. It was now just after 5 in the morning. She wasn't familiar with the night desk sergeant, but he signed out the keys to her for the Douglas Brown house. The roads were quiet as she drove over to Chiswick. The office buildings loomed tall and empty as she navigated her way through Elephant and Castle, crossing the Thames at Blackfriars Bridge, and then following the river along the embankment. The view of the river was dimmed by a low fog, which turned blue as the dawn broke. Erica placed a call to Moss, but she got her answering machine. "Hi, it's Erica. It's coming up to 5:30. I'm just on my way over to the Douglas Brown house. Something is bugging me about Linda. I want to take a look at her bedroom. If I'm not back by 7, interview her again and get Peterson to lead. She seems to have taken a shine to him. Get her talking about cats. I know it sounds mad, but I think there's something there. I can't put my finger on it. She's cat crazy, but she doesn't have a cat." Her phone gave 3 bleeps and then cut off. "Shit," Erica cried, looking down at her dead phone. She'd barely been back at the hotel long enough to charge it. She arrived on Chiswick High Road. She tucked her phone in her pocket and parked on one of the back streets, realising she would have to be quick and would need to travel back on the underground to have any hope of making it to the station before the 24 hours expired. Chapter 70. The Douglas Brown house sat resplendent at the end of the cul-de-sac, dominating the street like a polished buttery block. Mist hung in the air, and the street lights blinked off as she reached the house. The front gate was well-oiled and opened soundlessly. The bay windows stared back at her blankly. She went to the front door and pressed the bell, hearing it ring deep from within the house. A moment passed, then she started to try the bunch of keys in the front lock. The third key she tried opened the door. She listened for a moment and then came inside, closing the door behind her. She made for the hallway, past the grandfather clock with its swinging pendulum, and into the vast steel and granite kitchen. It was still and immaculate. Copper pots hung from a frame above a large granite island, and the back wall was floor-to-ceiling glass. Beyond, she could see the landscaped garden. A blackbird landed on the smooth grass, but seeing Erica move inside, it took flight. Erica came back out and climbed the sweeping staircase up to the second floor, moving past smart, neutral guest rooms, a marble bathroom, until at the end of the corridor at the back of the house, Erica found Linda's room. The door was closed, with a small sign saying, "Welcome to Linda's bedroom. Please knock before entering." Under it, and almost obliterated with crossings out, was written, "'Cause I might not be wearing any knickers." Erica couldn't help but smile and thought it must have been David. Little brothers like to tease. She opened the door and went inside. Chapter 71 "'I've had a message from the boss,' said Moss, when she came into the incident room. Peterson had arrived at the same time, bringing in a tray of coffee. He was handing them out to the officers, who were arriving bleary-eyed and taking off their coats. "'She wants us to go ahead and bring Linda back first for questioning.'
"'Has her solicitor showed up yet?' asked Peterson.
"'Yeah, I saw him in reception. He doesn't look happy, being pulled in at this ungodly hour.'
"'Oh, well, it will all be over by 9,' said PC Singh, coming up and going to grab the last coffee.
"'Sorry, I need that one,' snapped Moss. "'Go and get one from the machine.'
"'That was a bit harsh,' said Peterson when Singh had walked off.
"'She made it sound like we're just clock-watching until 9 a.m., like it's a formality.'
"'Isn't it?' asked Peterson awkwardly.
"'No,' said Moss pointedly. "'Now listen, the boss has had an idea.'
Chapter 72 Linda's bedroom was small and gloomy. A sash window with a deep cushioned window seat overlooked the garden, and from above, Erica could see that the lawn was still dotted with a few patches of dirty snow. A heavy dark wardrobe stood beside the window. The door creaked as Erica opened it. On one side hung a selection of dark, voluminous skirts. Next to these was a block of crisply ironed white blouses, some with lacework on the collar, and the rest of the wardrobe was taken up by a huge selection of cat jumpers, all thick and heavy. At the bottom of the wardrobe was a jumble of court shoes, some sensible sandals, a pair of powder-blue running shoes, a dusty pair of ice skates, and a pink thigh master. A single bed with a dark wood frame was tucked in the corner against the back wall, and above its curved wooden headboard was a thick metal crucifix. A line of toy cats sat guard on the neatly made patchwork bedspread. They were arranged in descending height order. Their Disney-esque eyes looked heartbreakingly optimistic amongst the sad gloom. Erica paused for a moment to consider that Linda had made her bed and arranged the cats before she was hauled into a police car. On the bedside table was a small Tiffany-style lamp and a little curved plastic box containing a clear plastic bite guard. There was also a small picture in a frame taken a few years back, of Linda sitting on a swing chair in the garden with a beautiful black cat on her lap. It had white fur on its paws. Erica picked up the frame and turned it over, unhooking the metal clasps and pulling off the cardboard backing. On the back of the photo, in a neat hand, was written, "My darling boy, Boots, and me." Erica held on to the photo as she carried on looking around. An old-fashioned secretary desk in matching dark wood was against the wall at the end of the bed. It was filled with pens and a girly stationery set. A large square in the dust showed where the police had removed Linda's laptop. A dressing table between the window and the secretary desk held the bare minimum of makeup, a large pot of E45 cream and a bag of cotton wool balls. A brush lay on its side, and strands of Linda's mousy hair caught the light from the window. Beside the door was a large bookcase, crammed with novels by Jackie Collins and Judith Krantz, and scores of historical romance novels. There was a couple of photos from the family holidays in Croatia, Portugal and Slovakia, mainly of Linda and Andrea with various stray cats, and there was a photo of Linda standing at the base of a cliff with a large tanned guy with dirty blonde hair. Linda wore climbing gear and a red plastic hard hat. She was grinning so hard that the chin strap cut into her shiny tanned face. There was nothing written on the back of the photo. On the wall beside the door was a large pinboard with a photo collage. The photos were pinned overlapping and were all of Boots, the beautiful black cat with the white paws. Linda sat astride a bike with a wicker basket where Boots perched on a blanket. Linda on a swing in the garden with Boots on her lap. Andrea and Linda eating breakfast in the kitchen, Boots sprawled on his back across the middle of the breakfast bar, holding a piece of toast in his white paws. Linda and Andrea's heads were thrown back, laughing. There was a picture of Boots on Simon's desk,
lounging on a pile of paperwork. Despite him being in the middle of something, he had allowed Linda to take a photo of his work being disrupted. Erica began to remove the pins and take away the photos. In several of the photos where they overlapped, a figure had either been cut out or the end of the photo had been snipped off unevenly. Scanning the photos of family gatherings, Erica realized who the missing person was.
Chapter 73. Linda looked drained when Peterson entered the interview room. Her hair was tousled, and she didn't look like she'd got much sleep in her cell. The solicitor finished polishing his glasses and put them back on.
"Here, I got you a coffee, Linda," said Peterson, sitting opposite and pushing the takeaway cup towards her. The solicitor saw Peterson had a coffee of his own and looked annoyed that he hadn't been included. Peterson tilted up his cup to the light.
"Look, they never get it right. I said my name was Peterson. They've written Peter Son."
Linda stared at him for a moment and then reached out for her cup and checked the side.
"They got my name right," she said.
She turned the cup and her face broke into a smile.
"Oh, and they drew a little cat, look."
She twisted the cup round so Peterson could see.
"I thought you'd like that," Peterson grinned.
Linda's eyes narrowed.
"I see what you're doing," she said.
She sat back and pushed the cup away.
"I'm not that easy."
"I never thought you were," said Peterson. He read out his name and the time and the interview tape started recording.
"Linda, you said yesterday you didn't have a cat."
"No, I don't," she said, cautiously sipping at her coffee.
"Did you?"
"Yes, I did," she said softly.
"His name was Boots."
"Boots?"
"Yes, he was black, but he had four white paws, like he was wearing boots."
The minutes ticked by, and Linda became quite animated, talking about Boots. She was just telling Peterson about how Boots used to sleep under the covers with her, with his head on her pillow, when the solicitor interrupted.
"Look, D.I. Peterson, what has this got to do with your investigation?"
"I'm talking about my cat, thank you very much," Linda snapped back.
"I'm working for you here, Miss Douglas Brown."
"Yes, you are, and I'm talking about my fucking cat, okay?"
"Yes, very well," said the solicitor.
Linda turned back from the solicitor to Peterson.
"I'm sick of people who think cats are just pets. They're not. They're such intelligent, beautiful creatures."
Back in the observation room, Moss and Crane were watching.
"Keep her talking about Boots," said Moss into a microphone.
Inside the interview room, her voice came quietly through the earpiece Peterson wore.
"Did Boots have a middle name? I had a dog called Barnaby Clive," said Peterson.
"No, it was Boots Douglas Brown. That was quite enough. I wish I had a middle name or even a nicer name than just boring old Linda."
"I don't know, I like the name Linda," said Peterson.
"But Boots is so much more exotic."
"And what happened to Boots? I take it she's not still with us?"
asked Peterson.
"He. Boots was a he.
And no, he's not with us," said Linda. She gripped the edge of the desk.
"Are you okay? Is this upsetting to talk about how Boots died?" pressed Peterson.
"Of course it was upsetting. He died," shouted Linda.
There was a silence.
"Okay, this is good. Peterson, keep on at her. We're breaking her down," said Moss in his ear.
Chapter 74. The Douglas Brown house was silent and felt heavy and oppressive with secrets and unanswered questions. Erica hadn't noticed how long she'd spent in Linda's bedroom, staring at the family photos and absorbing the sadness emanating from Linda's possessions. She was now moving down the corridor, still clutching the photos of Boots the cat, and checking to see what was behind the doors. She passed empty guest bedrooms, a large bathroom, a huge linen closet, and two picture windows in the corridor, which looked onto the bare back wall of the house next door. At the other end of the floor, at the furthest point from Linda's room, Erica found David's bedroom. The door was open.
In comparison to Linda's, it was stylish and bright with a large metal-framed double bed and a long mirrored wardrobe. A poster of Che Guevara was framed on one wall, next to a Pirelli calendar, showcasing a beautiful blonde for January, her arms crossed over her bare chest. There was a faint smell of expensive aftershave, and on a large desk was a silver MacBook laptop, which was open, and beside it an iPod, docked into a large speaker set. On the wall above was a rack with six pairs of Skullcandy headphones in assorted bright colours. Erica spied a phone charger snaking out from behind the desk, and she pulled out her iPhone and hooked it up. A few moments passed, and when she saw it starting to charge, she switched it on. She went to the open MacBook and brushed her fingers over the trackpad. The screen lit up, showing that a password had to be entered. Large black and white prints of Battersea Power Station, the National Theatre, and Billingsgate Fish Market adorned the remaining wall space. A large set of shelves was stuffed with books on architecture, ranging from paperback guides to enormous coffee table photo books. As Erica glanced along the bookshelves, a bright blue cover caught her eye. Swimming London, London's 50 Greatest Swimming Spots. Erica pulled the book out and began to leaf through photos of swimming pools and lidos in London. A creeping feeling began to emerge from the pit of her stomach. Chapter 75. Back at Lewisham Row, Moss and Crane were watching the interview unfold on the video screens. Peterson was listening as Linda talked about Boots, her beloved cat. There was a knock, and Wolf put his head around the door.
"This just came through for DCI Foster," said Wolf.
He handed Moss a piece of paper. She scanned it quickly. "This is from Linda Douglas Brown's private Harley Street physician. He states she is mentally unfit to be questioned by the police."
"Geez, what are we dealing with here?" said Crane.
"Who bought this in?" asked Moss.
"Diana Douglas Brown. She's shown up with another lawyer," said Wolf.
"You need to stop this interview."
"We've been told she knows nothing, and yet this document is hand-delivered just before 7 in the morning, said Moss.
"You know I have your back, but this goes high up. Establishment stuff. I can see the edge of the cliff approaching," said Crane.
"Just a few minutes more, Wolf. Go back out. Come back in 10. Wolf reluctantly nodded and left.
"Okay, Peterson, push her harder," said Moss into the microphone.
"How did he die, Linda?" asked Peterson back in the interview room. "How did Boots die?"
Linda's bottom lip was now trembling, and she gripped the coffee cup, running her fingers over the tiny cartoon cat.
"None of your business."
"Were your family upset when Boots passed?"
"Yes."
"Andrea and David, they must have been younger too."
"Of course they were younger. Andrea was upset, but David..."
Linda's face clouded over. She bit down hard on her lip.
"What about David?" asked Peterson.
"Nothing. He was upset too," said Linda flatly.
"You don't look too convinced. Was David upset or wasn't he, Linda?"
She started to breathe fast, sucking in air and blowing it out, almost hyperventilating.
"He was upset too,"
said Linda, her eyes wide, looking at the floor.
"David was upset?" pushed Peterson. "I just said he was. He was fucking upset," shouted Linda.
"I think this is getting..."
started the solicitor, but Peterson went on.
"David's away at a stag party, isn't he, Linda?"
"Yes, I was surprised at how hard it was to let him go," she said.
She froze and frowned.
"He's only gone for a few days, hasn't he?"
asked Peterson. Linda was now crying, tears pouring down her cheeks.
"It's okay. He's coming back, Linda. David is coming back," said Peterson.
Linda was now gripping the desk and her face was red, her mouth curled up.
"My client is..." started the solicitor.
"I don't want him back,"
Linda hissed.
"Linda, why don't you want David back? It's okay, it's me, you can tell me," said Peterson. He could feel the air almost prickling with intensity in the interview room.
"Far away," said Linda darkly. "I want him gone far away. Gone. Gone."
"Why, Linda? Tell me why. Why do you want David gone far away?"
Because he killed my cat. She suddenly cried. He killed Boots. Killed Boots? No one believed me. They all thought I was making it up, but he killed my baby cat. He killed Giles's cat too, and made it look like it was me, that fucking bastard.
David killed your cat, said Peterson.
Yes. How did he kill him?
Asked Peterson. Linda was now turning purple, gripping the desk, trying to rock it, but it was bolted to the floor. The words were pouring out of her now.
He strangled him. He strangled him, like...
Linda bit down on her lip so hard that a spot of blood oozed out. Like who, Linda?
Like those girls,
she finished in a tortured whisper.
Chapter 76 Erica's hands were shaking as she began to leaf through the book in David's bedroom. As she flicked through the pages, her heart pounded faster. She saw a section for the Serpentine Lido, another for Brockwell Lido, Hampstead Heath Ponds, the Serpentine Lido, all of the murder scenes, apart from the Horniman Museum. In each section, notes had been written around the photos and text in a manic hand. On some pages, the notes filled all of the blank space around the photos, noting where the entrances and exits were, whether there were CCTV cameras, what the opening times were of each location, where the best place was to take a car and conceal it nearby. Then Erica reached a double-page map in the back, where all the locations had been marked out and circled. It was identical to the map in the incident room. Erica dropped the book with a thud, and went to the desk where her phone was now switched on and charging. She picked up the phone and started to scroll through, searching for Moss or Crane's extension number back at Lewisham Row. Then she sensed movement, and a shadow behind her. A hand closed over hers, ripping the phone from her grasp.
Chapter 77 Chief Superintendent Marsh had entered the observation suite just as Linda had broken down, revealing David as the killer. He watched with Moss and Crane in horrified silence as Linda lost control. She was raging, pulling at her hair, her face red, spittle flying from her mouth.
David killed Boots in front of me. He strangled him. No one believed me when I said he did it. No one. They all thought I was lying. That I did it.
You said David killed girls. Which girls? Asked Peterson.
Girls. The type you pay for. He spent so much on those girls.
What do you mean, spent so much?
Money, you fucking idiot, roared Linda. And not his own money. Oh, no, Daddy paid it off. Daddy paid it off, but wouldn't buy me a new cat. Because they said I'd lied about David killing him. They believed him over me, a fucking murderer. Am I worth less than a murderer, am I? Daddy was happy to spend thousands, thousands.
Why did he have to spend thousands, Linda? Who did he give the thousands to? Asked Peterson.
To Igor, Andrea's fucking fuck buddy for the girls.
And your father paid him off? Asked Peterson.
He gave Giles the money to pay him off, and he's given David money to leave the country. All that money, and he wouldn't buy me a little kitten.
Linda tilted her head back and brought it crashing down on the tabletop. She lifted it and brought it crashing down again.
Stop! Stop! Cried Peterson.
The solicitor had now retreated to the corner of the room. Peterson went to the wall and triggered the panic alarm. It blared out around the station. He turned and looked up at the camera.
I need help in here now.
Where's DCI Foster? Asked Marsh, back in the observation suite. Moss paused, the colour draining from her face. Jesus, she's gone to the Douglas Brown house.
Chapter 78 Erica spun round and found herself face to face with David, who was standing across from her in his bedroom. He was dressed in a green sweater, a dark body warmer and jeans. He pulled the SIM card from her phone and broke it in two with a small snap. He dropped the handset, and there was a cracking, splintering sound as he ground it into the carpet with the heel of his boot. Erica regarded David's face. It was as if his mask of youth and attractive confidence had fallen away. His nostrils flared. His eyes blazed. He looked evil. She could see it all so clearly now,
She had been so stupid. I thought you were away, David, said Erica.
I will be away, on a stag weekend.
Erica looked down at the book. It lay on the carpet, its pages open to the map of London.
It's not marked in the book, but you killed Andrea too, didn't you?
Said Erica evenly.
Yes, I did. Pity, really, she was much more fun than Linda, said David. I can see what you're thinking, why Andrea and not Linda?
Is that what you're thinking, David?
No, Linda has proved to be an asset. She'll take the rap for Andrea's murder. Igor Kucherov will go down for the whores. They were his whores, after all. And Ivy Norris, well, that piece of trash belonged in the ground.
Can you hear yourself?
Yes, I can, sneered David.
Why did you do it?
David shrugged.
You can just shrug it off.
That I don't believe, said Erica.
Believe it, he hissed. You think you can analyze me, rationalize what I did, why I killed? I did it because I can.
But you can't, David. You won't get away with it. There will be consequences.
You wouldn't know what it's like to grow up privileged and powerful. It's intoxicating.
Watching how people defer to you and to your parents.
Power reeks from your pores, and it infects people around you. Power corrupts, envelops, entices. The more powerful my father becomes, the more he fears losing it.
So he knew you killed Mirka, Tatiana, Karolina?
Of course. Not that he was thrilled. But they were East European girls. They all think they can suck and fuck their way to greatness.
What about Andrea? She was your sister, your father's favourite.
She was threatening to tell Mother. She said she was going to go to the fucking press, stupid girl. First lesson of life in the establishment, keep your mouth shut, or someone will shut it for you permanently.
I can't believe your father was willing to cover even that up, to let it go that you killed his beloved daughter.
Shut up, you don't know what you're talking about. He fears a fall from grace more than anything else. He fears that the other wolves will descend and tear him apart. Fear is more powerful than love.
He found himself with the choice to save Linda or me.
Linda's halfway to being off a fucking rocker anyway. And she hated Andrea so much she probably would have done it herself.
Linda wouldn't have killed Andrea, said Erica.
You're sticking up for her now, Jesus. Well, I suppose most people feel pity for her when they've paid a visit to her bedroom.
You know, when my friends used to come for sleepovers, we'd find her little cat and lock it in one of the huge petty cash tins from my father's office. We'd make her do all sorts to get the key back.
Erica forced herself to keep eye contact with David. Boots, that was her cat.
Yes, dear old Boots. Linda used to go into terrible rages when she didn't get her way.
I used one of those to dispose of Boots. Strangulation, in case you were curious. Have you ever tried to strangle a cat?
No.
Kill a rabbit? You Slovaks like a bit of bunny, don't you?
No.
It's the claws with cats. They go ballistic. They put up an admirable fight for survival.
Your parents are intelligent people. They must have known it was you who killed the cat, said Erica.
That's the problem when you delegate your child's upbringing. Hiring nannies, you just play a walk-on role. You see the children before bath time, an hour here and there. Don't come too close, darling. I'm dressed up for the evening out. Your child becomes a bunch of statistics. He got an A in maths. He can play Fiorelis on the piano. Let's get him a polo pony so we can mix with the polo set.
David seemed to drift off for a moment and then came back to the room. Anyway, I take it your questioning of all concerned has been fruitless. My father has made their silence very lucrative, and Linda will take the rap for killing Andrea. I made her promise.
Why would she promise?
I said that if she did, she could have another cat and not have to live in fear of me disposing of it.
You can't be serious, said Erica.
I am. She'll plead insanity, end up in some expensive clinical facility for a few years. My father will probably bung some orderly a few quid to poke her in that aching place between her thighs. They might even let her have a cat. She'll give a little pussy to get a little pussy.
David started to laugh. It was high-pitched, unhinged.
Erica took the opportunity and made a dash for the bedroom door, but David was quicker. He grabbed her. His hands encircled her neck and he slammed her into the bookcase, knocking the air from her lungs. But this time she was ready for him.
She brought her arm up and punched him in the nose with the heel of her hand. There was a satisfying crack as the cartilage snapped and his grip loosened. Erica managed to push him away and made for the door, but he caught her arm just before she was through and wheeled her back round. She slammed into the desk and he was on her again. Blood was now gushing down his chin, and a look of pure rage contorted his face. Erica kicked and flailed, all the while gasping and trying to force air back into her winded lungs. She thrashed under his grip, but he held on, trying to control her arms climbing on top of her. He successfully pinned one of her arms down using his knee. With her free hand, she scrabbled around on the desk and grabbed a smooth paperweight and smashed it against his ear. He lost grip on her, and she managed to scramble from under him, again making for the door, but he recovered quickly, throwing out one of his long legs and tripping her up. She fell, and he loomed over her, his face now a mess of blood, coating his teeth as he gave a manic grin. She fought, scratching and kicking, fighting like an animal to get out from under him, but he pinned her down. Lifting his arm, he punched her in the face once, twice. When he struck her the third time, Erica felt one of her teeth hit the back of her throat, and then everything went black. Chapter 79.
Sir, DCI Foster switched on her phone half an hour ago. The signal came from the Douglas Brown house, said Peterson.
The incident room was now up and running with a full-scale manhunt for David Douglas Brown.
I want a team of officers sent over to the house now. I want a full-arm search conducted. Close off a 5-mile radius around the house. Put out an arrest warrant on David Douglas Brown. Circulate his photo.
Sir, we were told by Simon and Diana Douglas Brown that David had left the country and was attending a stag party in Prague. Passport and immigration show he's still here. He never left the country, said Crane.
I want him found, now and fast.
DCI Foster could be in danger, said Marsh.
And get Simon Douglas Brown out of his bloody cell and stick him in an interview room.
"Of course you realise all this is inadmissible," said Simon 20 minutes later when Marsh had outlined Linda's confession.
"My solicitor has informed me that you were faxed a statement from Linda's physician to show that basically anything that comes out of her mouth is inadmissible. She's gaga, always has been. As for David, he changed his plans without telling me, no crime in that. They must have moved the stag party."
Simon rose from his seat in the interview room.
Now I will be calling Assistant Commissioner Oakley later, where I'll be recommending that—
Shut your mouth, Simon, said Marsh.
I beg your pardon, said Simon.
Shut your mouth and sit down. You are still detained under caution, and I'm not finished with you yet. Sit down.
Simon looked shocked, and slowly sank back into his chair.
Now, an arrest warrant is out for your son, who we believe is responsible for the deaths of 5 women, including your own daughter.
Simon was silent.
We've also discovered that the phone Andrea lost and claimed on insurance was in your name. Andrea lied that it had been stolen, and we have the handset as evidence.
Marsh opened an envelope and dropped the plastic-wrapped, cracked handset on the table.
So I see it like this. At best, you'll be done for insurance fraud.
And you know how hard the government has lobbied for this.
It could mean prison time, and as well as you being a very unpopular boy in prison, it will no doubt open the floodgates to all kinds of people with grievances towards you. Journalists, politicians. Add into the mix that your own son killed your daughter, and you knowingly told him to skip the country while stitching up your other daughter.
All right, all right, shouted Simon. All right, I'll tell you.
Simon Douglas Brown, Baron of Hunstanton, I'm arresting you on charges of perverting the course of justice and concealing criminal activity. We also suspect that you used your position of power to influence the outcome of 1 or more Crown prosecution trials. Okay, start talking and fast, said Marsh.
Chapter 80. David had quickly cleaned himself up in the bathroom, packing his nose with tissue to stop the bleeding. He then grabbed his bag, passport and money, and carried Erica downstairs over his shoulder. He was surprised how heavy she was for someone so scrawny. They emerged into the underground garage, and the lights blinked on. He approached the boot of the car. Inside was the prostitute with the long dark hair he had picked up at Paddington Station. They'd driven around for a while,
he and the prostitute, the girl attempting to make him hard, her hand inside his trousers, but that hadn't interested him. It had been a busy night, and all his usual places, the parks and lidos, had too much action going on. People walking about, police cars moving slowly past. He had been forced to bring her home. She had been so excited when he'd driven up to his parents' house, checking her face in the small mirror above the passenger seat, as if she hadn't been hired to fuck. She seemed to think she might be introduced to his parents. He wondered if she'd watched Pretty Woman too many times. He'd laughed when he thought this, and she'd joined in. Stupid bitch. Once they were in the underground garage, and they were out of the car, he slammed her face into the concrete wall. She never regained consciousness. This had made the moment when she died disappointing. Still, he now had the ultimate prize, DCI Foster. When he opened the boot of the car, the dead girl lay on her back. He had checked on her three times since he had strangled her to death, and each time it fascinated him to see how she'd changed, through the rigid, wide-eyed stare of rigor mortis to the tinge of purple on her skin, where she looked as if she was sleeping, and now her sharp cheekbones buried beneath swollen, bloated flesh, making her bruises bloom dark like ink stains. He laughed at her swollen face. She would hate to see how fat she was getting. He heaved Erica's limp body in beside her, closed the boot, and locked it. It was still early in the morning when he pulled out of the underground garage and into the cul-de-sac, but he drove carefully for the couple of miles to the M4 junction. Once on the motorway, he was able to join the rush-hour traffic, whipping round the M25 motorway orbiting the outskirts of London. Erica felt herself regain consciousness, but the darkness was absolute. Her face was pressed against something rough. One arm was pinned under her at an angle. She brought the other arm up to touch her face, but her hand hit a solid mass a few inches above her head. She shifted, feeling the pain shoot through her face. She tasted blood and swallowed painfully. There was a rumbling, swaying motion underneath her. She felt around her the curved sides of the confined space, the metal above her, the inside mechanism of the lock, and realized she was in the boot of a car. Then a foul, pungent smell hit her. It had a tang of rot, and she heaved, barely able to catch her breath when she was forced to suck the rancid smell back into her lungs in the confined space. The car sped up and took a turn, the road bumping unevenly underneath. The gravitational force pushed Erica across to the edge of the boot, and something heavy rolled against her. It was then that she knew she was in the back of the car with a body. Chapter 81. Information was coming through to the incident room fast, and Moss and Peterson were realizing with horror that DCI Foster could be the next victim. The Douglas Brown house had been searched and was empty. Erica's car had been found parked two streets away, and the number plate for David's car had been photographed leaving the west section of London's congestion charge zone. Simon Douglas Brown's secretary bought David a one-way ticket on the Eurostar to Paris, said Crane, coming off the phone. So not Prague, said Moss. Shit, what about DCI Foster? Asked Peterson.
She's not in the house, she's not in her car, she must be in his, said Moss.
Crane, how fast can we scramble a helicopter?
When Chief Superintendent Marsh gives the order, 4 minutes, said Crane.
Okay, I'm calling Marsh, said Moss.
Chapter 82. The junction sign for Ebbsfleet International train station loomed above, and David indicated and took the exit off the M25, slowing as he hit the ramp, which curved round and changed to a single-lane carriageway. The A2 was busy with cars, but they peeled off at the turning for the Blue Water Shopping Centre, its futuristic glass spires emerging from where it sat deep in an old chalk quarry. David drove on, speeding past empty industrial wasteland, grass, and the occasional tree dotting the scrubland. He slowed when he saw the lay-by up ahead, and then turned off. He came to a halt, and had to get out of the car to unhook a chain which hung across a small dirt track. Erica had struggled to control the fear climbing her throat, the fear of being boxed in with a dead girl, and of what would happen when they reached their destination. She had forced herself to check for signs of life, and during this had discovered the body was that of a girl with long hair, whose life had long since left her. Her eyes had adjusted to the dark, and she could make out two tiny pinpricks of light next to the inside of the locking mechanism. She had run her hands over it, slowly at first, feeling its sharp, greasy contours for a weakness, a way of prizing it open. The car had lurched and the body had rolled against her again. And for a brief moment she'd panicked, clawing at the lock and breaking two of her fingernails below the quick. The pain had pulled her away from the brink of losing it, and she'd forced herself to think, to remain calm, to survive. She'd found a small hole in the carpeting underneath her, used to pull out the layer of carpet where underneath were kept the tools and spare wheel. She'd had to lie to one side on top of the dead girl to get the carpet up far enough to reach under where she'd found a wrench. She had it now in her grip. It was cold, but her hands were sweating. She felt the car come to a stop and braced herself. A door opened and weight shifted. Moments later the car lurched as David got back in. She heard a door close again. And then the car set off slowly, lurching from side to side, its suspension creaking. She felt the body beside her move, and the weight shifted so that it rolled onto her, the hair on its scalp pressing against the back of her head. She closed her eyes and tried to think, to focus on what she would do. David drove slowly along the bumpy track, which opened out to a vast, disused chalk quarry. In the centre was a deep pit filled with water. He came to a stop 20 yards from the edge and killed the engine. He got out of the car and walked to the edge. The quarry walls were smooth. Tufts of grass grew in patches, and a small tree emerged from a break in the rock. 50 feet below, the water was still, and the weak morning sunlight bounced off dim, blurry patches where the water was still frozen. To the left, the Blue Water Shopping Centre sat low on the horizon, and a couple of miles in the opposite direction, a high-speed train left Ebbsfleet International, streaking past silently on its way to the Eurotunnel crossing to Paris. David checked his watch. There was just enough time. He removed his rucksack and placed it on the ground, a few feet from the car. He opened the back passenger door and made sure the child lock was activated. He then grabbed the heavy steering wheel lock from the passenger footwell and moved round to the boot of the car. He listened for a moment, braced himself with a steering wheel lock, and then opened the boot. The stench was worse in the clean air of the quarry, and the putrid smell rose up, hitting him in the face. Both bodies were still. He leant in to pull Erica out, but her arms shot out as she caught him on the side of his head with a wrench. He staggered back for a moment, seeing stars, but as she started to climb from the boot, he swung the steering lock round and hit her on the side of her left knee. She collapsed onto the ground, groaning. He did the same to her right knee. She cried out again. David grabbed her and dragged her round to the rear passenger seat. "Don't fight me," he said. "David, it doesn't have to end like this," gasped Erica through the pain, seeing the vast expanse of water stretching out below them. She couldn't move her legs, and one of her arms was dead from being pinned under her in the car. Her head was still woozy where she had been hit, and she was fighting to think. Her head struck the doorframe as David hauled her body into the car. The door slammed, and she looked around, seeing she was in the back, sitting behind the driver's seat. She caught sight of her face in the mirror. Her blonde hair was slick with blood on one side and plastered against her scalp. One eye was so blackened and swollen that it was closed. She tried the door beside her, but it wouldn't open. She leaned across, groaning in agony, and tried the other passenger door. It too wouldn't open. The front passenger door opened, sucking out the air, which was replaced by the stench of death. David was carrying the body of the dead girl, looking more horrific than Erica had imagined. The girl had long dark hair, but her face was swollen with two black eyes and multiple cuts. Strands of hair had been pulled out from the side of her head. Erica looked down and saw strands of the girl's hair stuck to her own jacket. David shoved the girl into the front passenger seat, and her head flopped to one side. Erica could see that her eyes were a pearly blue, and her tongue had swollen, oozing from her mouth like a huge purple-black slug.
"David, listen. I don't know what you're planning, but you won't get away with it. If you surrender now, I can...
You really are an arrogant bitch, aren't you? He said, peering through the seats. Here you are, with the shit beaten out of you, stuck inside a car in the middle of nowhere, and you think I'm going to surrender to you? David!
He leant over and punched her hard in the face.
Her head jerked back and bounced off the passenger windscreen. Blackness flooded her vision for a moment. When she came to, she felt a seatbelt being pulled around her and fastened with a click. The door beside her slammed shut. David peered through the seats, taking off the handbrake. She felt the wheels jerk free.
"It looks like it's going to freeze again tonight," he said.
The driver's door slammed, and seconds later, the car began to roll forward towards the edge of the quarry. The car quickly picked up speed. David broke into a run, still pushing. He pulled back a few meters from the edge, and the car surged forward and vanished over the edge. Erica felt the wheels leave the edge of the quarry. The horizon seemed to fly upwards, and was replaced by bright blue hurtling towards the windscreen. David had strapped both her and the dead girl in, but the whiplash from the impact was excruciating nevertheless. The car was submerged in bright blue for a moment, and then righted itself and broke the surface, the interior blazing with natural light. Erica searched frantically for the seatbelt clasp, but it wouldn't open. The windows had been left open a few inches, and ice-cold water was surging inside, rapidly filling the car. Erica had expected to have time to react. She tried to open the door, but the child lock was still activated. Water flooded in the windows, and within seconds the freezing water rose to her chest. Panicking, Erica grabbed as deep a breath as she could, and the roaring sound from above ceased as she was submerged. The car began to sink at a terrifying rate, down, deeper, and darker. The weight of the engine sent them into a head-on collision with the bottom of the quarry. The police helicopter reached the edge of the quarry. As far below, they saw David's car roll over the edge and hit the water. Moss and Peterson were in the helicopter with a police pilot. They had an open radio linked to the incident room in Lewisham Row, and backup vehicles and an ambulance were on their way. "Suspect is running," said Moss, training the gyroscope camera fixed to the bottom of the helicopter, beaming the images back to the incident room. "Put police on alert. Suspect is running from the scene north towards Ebbsfleet Station." "Shit, what if she's in that car? How far are the backup vehicles?" asked Peterson. "Backup vehicles are 4 or 5 minutes away," said Marsh over the radio. "DCI Foster must be in that car. Land, land, land!" yelled Moss into the radio. The helicopter descended fast. The white chalk of the quarry came rushing up towards them, and the helicopter had barely set down before Moss and Peterson jumped out, ducking under the spinning blades, holding their hands up against the flying dust. The seconds were racing past, and below, bubbles were flooding up to the surface and rippling out into a large circle in the water. "You are authorized to shoot, but we want him brought in alive," they heard Marsh say on the radio. Peterson made for an access slope at the side of the quarry, running flat out to reach it. Moss followed, shouting into her radio. "We believe there is an officer in the car which went over the side and into the water. I repeat, an officer is trapped in the car underwater." 3 minutes away," came a voice. "Shit, we haven't got 3 minutes," cried Moss. The helicopter hovered above, flew over the lip of the quarry, and sank down until it was just above the spreading bubbles on the surface. Peterson was now at the water's edge, and without hesitation, ripped off his jacket and gun and waded into the water, swimming out, his arms arcing from side to side. He reached the spot where the car had submerged and dived under. "Can you report? Suspect is on the run. Do we have backup at Ebbsfleet Station? I repeat, do we have backup? If he gets on the fucking train," came Marsh's voice over the radio. "Backup on its way and the station is being shut down," answered a voice. "Moss, report. Our visual shows Peterson is in the water." "Yes, sir, D.I. Peterson is under the water. I repeat, D.I. Peterson is under the water," said Moss into her radio. She was now standing at the water's edge. "Jesus," said Marsh. There was radio silence as the helicopter roared and hovered, pressing an oval shape into the water. Seconds ticked by. "Come on, please, come on," said Moss. She was about to wade in after Peterson, when he broke the surface, holding Erica's limp body. The quarry above was suddenly filled with the screaming sirens of an ambulance, fire engine, and police support cars. Above the water, a safety line came down from the helicopter, and Peterson managed to hook it over both himself and Erica. He gave the thumbs up, and they were lifted out of the water, their feet skimming above, as they were half-carried, half-dragged over towards Moss at the edge.
DCI looks badly injured, and she appears unconscious, said Moss into her radio.
There's an access road to the left side where you've come in. We're down by the water. I repeat, DCI Foster looks unresponsive, cried Moss.
Peterson and Erica reached the edge of the water, and the helicopter set them down. Four paramedics raced down the slope to the water's edge. They unhooked Erica from the safety line and gently laid her on the ground. Peterson was drenched and shivering, and a foil blanket was quickly put over him. The paramedics started to work on Erica. There were a few tense moments, and then Erica gasped, coughing up water. "It's okay, on your side," said the paramedic, tipping her into the recovery position. She coughed, and more water shot out of her mouth. She gasped, pulling clean, cold air into her lungs.
"DCI Foster is out of the water and she's alive," said Moss. "Thank fuck she's alive."
Chapter 83. There was a soft hissing sound and a rhythmic beep as Erica's vision slowly swam into focus. She was in a hospital room beside a window. The blinds were closed, and a soft nightlight filled the room. In the corner of her vision was another bed. The bed covers moved up and then down, matching the hissing sound that she had heard. She rolled her tongue around the dry mouth and realized that the patient in the bed next to her was on a ventilator. Blue blankets were pulled up around her, and great swathes of her body felt completely numb. Her legs, one arm, the left side of her face. She felt no pain, just an uneasy feeling that pain was close by. Right now she was floating above the pain, but it would come soon and then she would have to deal with it. For now she could float above it, observing. Numb body, numb emotions. She closed her eyes and drifted off. When she woke again it was dark, and Marsh was sitting beside her bed. He wore a smart shirt and his leather jacket. The pain was starting to encroach. Her face, her legs, her arm. She also felt closer to her emotions, to the fear, the memories, that she thought she was going to die, the burning in her lungs when she hadn't been able to hold her breath anymore and she'd pulled in water, the dead girl in the back of the car with her, and then the girl's blurred face when the car had submerged, her dark hair spreading out in a halo around her head. "You're going to be okay," said Marsh, reaching over and gently taking Erica's right hand. She noticed her left hand was bandaged and that she could only hear on one side, the opposite side to where Marsh was sitting. "You've had an operation. You've got a pin in one of your legs and a fractured cheek." Marsh tailed off. He was clutching a bunch of grapes on his lap. It was almost comical. "You'll make a full recovery. I've put a card on your bedside table. Everyone at the station has signed it. You did well, Erica. I'm proud of you." Erica tried to say something. On her third attempt, she managed it. "David?"
"They arrested him at Ebbsfleet. He's in custody along with his father, Giles Osborne and Igor Kucherov. Isaac went back through the forensic evidence and has found a match to some small hair fibres found on Mirka Bratova, the second victim. They match David's DNA. And we have Linda's testimony, and forensics are all over the car. They pulled it out of the quarry with the girl inside."
Marsh smiled awkwardly. He reached out and took Erica's hand. "Anyway, there's plenty of time to tell you everything. What I really wanted to say is that I'm here if you need anything. And I'm here as a friend, Marcy sends a love. And she went out and got you some toiletries. I've put them in your locker." Erica tried to smile, but the pain was becoming sharp and angry. A nurse came in and checked Erica's chart. She went to the drip and pressed a button.
"Peterson, I want to thank Peterson," said Erica.
There was a beep, and Erica felt a coldness trickle through her hand. Marsh and the hospital room blurred to a pain-free whiteness. Epilogue. Erica breathed deeply, feeling the clean air fill her lungs. Next to her, on the wooden bench, Edward did the same. It was a comfortable silence as they stared out at the moors, which spread away in greens and browns. Clouds hung heavy in the distance, twirling into a knot of blue-black, which was heading their way.
"There's a storm brewing," said Edward.
"Just a minute longer. I love it here."
"Even the grass is greener up north," said Erica.
Edward laughed beside her.
"Is that a metaphor, lass?"
"No, it really is greener," she grinned. She pulled her eyes away from the beautiful view to Edward, who sat next to her, swaddled in his thick winter coat. A thin gravel path separated Mark's headstone from the bench where they sat.
"I'm finding it easier to come here now," said Edward.
"Once you get over being confronted with those letters in gold, his date of birth and the date when he, you know, I come here a lot and I talk to him."
Erica started to cry again. "I don't know where to start, what to say to him," she sobbed, searching her coat for a tissue.
"Just start," said Edward, handing her a little pack of tissues. He tilted her face up to his. Her hair was starting to grow back at the patch on the side where she'd had a long row of stitches.
"Okay," she said, pulling out a tissue and wiping her face.
"Tell you what, I'll knit back, put the kettle on. You just talk. Course, you'll feel like a lunatic at first, but there's no one about."
He patted Erica on the shoulder and started off down the path. She watched as he walked away. He turned and smiled before picking his way cautiously through the graves and down to the village. She noticed how similar his gait and his movements were to Mark's. She turned back to the grave.
"So, I solved 5 murders, and I narrowly escaped the murderer twice," she said. "But that's not what I came up here to tell you."
Her phone rang in her pocket. She pulled it out. It was Moss.
"Hello, boss. I thought it's been a couple of months and I'd give you a call."
"Hello," said Erica.
"Is it a bad time?"
"No, well, I'm just at Mark's grave."
"Oh, bugger, I'll call back."
"No, I've been trying to talk to him. My father-in-law says I should talk to him. He says it helps. I just don't know what to say."
"You could tell him that your murderer is going to trial in May.
Did you see today's news? David Douglas Brown was declared fit to stand trial. They've also expelled Sir Simon from the Lords. And it looks like Igor Kucherov will be retried for the murder of Nadia Greco. We're just waiting on the CPS about Giles Osborne. I'm confident he'll be done for perverting the course of justice."
"You there, boss?"
"Yes, and I did see.
And Mark doesn't want to hear all that. If I was stuck laying 6 feet under, I'd want my loved ones to keep me up to date on current events."
There was a silence. The wind rippled across the grass. The knot of black cloud was almost above her now.
"Sorry, I'm being crass," said Moss.
"No, you're being honest, which is far better.
Did Peterson get my card?"
"Yes, but you know him, the strong, silent type. He came to see you after in the hospital, but you were out of it."
"I know he did."
There was another silence. "So, when you back, boss?"
"I don't know. Soon. Marsh has told me to take as long as I need. I'm going to stay up here with Edward for a bit."
"Well, we're looking forward to you coming back, boss. You are coming back, aren't you?"
"Yeah, I'm coming back," said Erica. "I'll call you."
"Good. Well, enjoy yourself up there, and when you, you know, talk to Mark, say hi from me."
"That's the weirdest request for passing on a hello," said Erica wryly.
"I just wish I could have met him," said Moss. Erica came off the phone as thunder began to rumble overhead. She turned back to the grave and stared at the gold letters on the black granite. "In memory of Mark Foster. 1st of August 1970 to 8th of July 2014. Loved and remembered always."
"That's the toughest word, Mark," said Erica. "Always. I'll always be without you. I don't know how I can live without you, but I have to. To move on, I have to let you go at some point.
I have to keep going, Mark. Keep working. Keep living my life. Most days I don't think I can go on without you. But I have to. There's so much bad stuff out there that the only way I think I can cope with it all is to keep